This is All Things Considered on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. And now it's time for Ask Civics 101. It's a chance for you to get your questions answered about how our government works. Today, we're going to talk about the Supreme Court. We've been getting a lot of questions about the Supreme Court since the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And here now, with answers to your questions, Hannah McCarthy, co-host of Civics 101, NHPR's podcast about how our government works. Hi, Hannah.
Peter, thanks for having me.
So the Supreme Court at top of mind for so many people, causing a lot of anxiety on both sides of the aisle. And we've gotten a lot of questions over the years about the Supreme Court. So I figured we could kill many birds with one stone. How does the Supreme Court work? How do justice appointments work?
So I'll say that if we're going to start with the constitutional basis for the Supreme Court, right, the very foundation, what did the framers intend? What's actually written? The Constitution doesn't do much more than say that there has to be a Supreme Court and that there can be lower courts beneath it. In addition to that, says that judges of both the Supreme and inferior courts shall hold their offices during, quote, good behavior. You tell me what that means. That's up to interpretation. And, quote, shall at times receive for their services a compensation. And the only thing about getting paid is that that compensation cannot be lowered while they are serving in that office. But if you're looking for a meaning beyond that, I'll just tell you that Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 78, writing about the judiciary, said that it was beyond comparison the weakest of the three departments of power. It can never attack the other two. It's the weakest one compared to the legislative and the executive branches.
What has it looked like previously?
Of course. So the first iteration of the Supreme Court is established by something called the Federal Judiciary Act of 1789, way back at our beginning. And it was just six justices. And Peter, initially they met in the Merchants Exchange Building in New York City. And later they met in the basement of the Capitol Building in Washington. The Supreme Court did not get its own building until 1935. So it had been around for 146 years before anyone thought to give this whole branch of the government its own building, if that gives you a sense of how important and powerful it used to be considered.
Okay, so how did it become the powerful entity that it is today?
Yeah. So I would say, and I think a lot of scholars would say, one of the most important and powerful things about the Supreme Court is that it can rule on the constitutionality of law, right? Can either say that a federal law is constitutional or in violation of the Constitution. And the interesting thing is that that principle is established in an 1803, way back when, Supreme Court case called Marbury versus Madison. And the case itself is a little bit convoluted, but ultimately what happens is the Chief Justice at the time, John Marshall, pretty much clarified that the ultimate role of the Supreme Court is to uphold constitutionality and strike down laws in violation of the Constitution. But, you know, you might say, so why didn't it get its own building for 146 years if it's this great lofty institution that interprets the constitutionality of things? The court stayed away from striking down federal statute until 1857 in Dred Scott v. Sanford, right? So there wasn't for a while a lot of attention paid to this principle that we call judicial review. But as the Supreme Court began ruling more and more on constitutionality, it was evident exactly how powerful this entity had become.
So as we've been hearing a lot in the news, the president nominates a new Supreme Court justice when there is a vacancy, and the Senate has a yes or no vote on that nominee. How does the party of the president who appoints a Supreme Court justice reflect in the justices themselves?
Yeah, this is a really important question because I think this is what a lot of people are quite concerned about because, you know, President Trump, part of the GOP, conservative leaning, is certainly going to appoint a conservative justice, which would outweigh the liberal justices quite heavily. It would be a 6-3 split there. But I'm going to bring in for a little bit of cooling of that idea, Larry Robbins. He's a lawyer who we interviewed. He was also an 18-time advocate in the Supreme Court representing the United States.
I think it's possible to overstate the significance of who appointed a particular judge or justice. I'm close to agreement with my old friend, who is now the Chief Justice, John Roberts, who I think, famously responded to one of the President Trump's tirades about Obama judges by saying there are no Obama judges, there are no Bush judges, there are just judges trying to do their level best.
So that might bring some comfort to those who are really worried about what's happening right now in the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and just to add a little bit more of a bomb, I do just want to bring in one more voice here, Catherine DiPaolo, who we interviewed for an episode that we did on the judiciary branch, who talked about the fact that these lawyers are smart, ideally rational human beings.
Well, we do have some examples of that. Certainly, the late Justice Scalia, probably one of the most conservative jurists we've had on the U.S. Supreme Court, was best friends with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, one of the more liberal justices we've seen in the history of the court. And they had this love of opera together. And they would go see operas and they would have dinner, you know, with the spouses and were really the best of friends. And, you know, you can't find two really more opposite people. A lot of the justices have said, you know, it's not like in Congress where, you know, I'm going to yell at you for having your position. I respect your position. I may not agree with your position, but you have the right to say that and we move on. So I think the fact that they are all trained lawyers and have gone through the advocacy processes in their careers and understand you're going to win some, you're going to lose some, I think is particularly important. And I think that's how the court continues to operate.
Okay. There's that, but then there's also the idea that, you know, just because they were friends doesn't mean, oh, okay, they're going to be conservative, both of them on this particular issue and then liberal on the other. They don't horse trade, in other words, this, the way we expect our lawmakers to.
Right, exactly. And I think that you do ideally get to see a Supreme Court where there are justices who are committed, again, to this judicial review principle, right? To ruling on the constitutionality of something. And one must hope that in their doing so, they're at the very least abiding by our foundational ideas and upholding a healthy democracy.
And of course, they are justices for as long as they choose to be once they are appointed, which does insulate them somewhat from political winds.
That's correct, Peter. Aside from death or resignation, those justices are there to stay. They often outlive the president who appointed them.
NHPR's Hannah McCarthy, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Peter.
That was NHPR's Hannah McCarthy, who, along with Nick Capodice, co-hosts Civics 101, a podcast about our government and how it works. And you can ask them questions about your government. What do you want to know? Send your question by email. The address is civics101@nhpr.org.